Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Delighted to get to be here with you on a Friday afternoon. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us on this Friday afternoon. I think we've got a really good show for you. And the work week, Jimmy Akin will be here tomorrow. I guess some people will, because for the 4th of July is on Tuesday, so maybe some for some people this is going to be like a four-day weekend. Not for us. We'll be here on Monday. I'm not complaining. I'm just informing. Before we head off into that long weekend for many people, we do have a very good show. That second hour, it'll be open form, as I said, with Jimmy Akin. And this hour, I got to say, I'm really happy to welcome him back. We haven't had Gary Machuda on for a long time. He's the author of, for Catholic Answers, several things, including Revolt Against Reality, Fighting the Enemies of Sanity and Truth from the Serpent to the State, a book that must be read if you want to understand these times that we live in, Revolt Against Reality. He also wrote Hostile Witnesses, How the Enemies of the Church Prove Christianity, The Case for the Deuterocanon, Arguments and Evidence, and Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger, which you hear us give away from time to time because we get a lot of people who call, and that is their question. Why are Catholic Bibles bigger? Or why did Catholics put extra books in the Bible? Or why did Protestants take books out of the Bible? And Gary knows that story better than probably just about anybody you know. He's also the host of Hands On Apologetics on Virgin Most Powerful Radio, and he's got a new book about how can we trust what we read in the Gospels about Jesus? How do we know that we actually have an accurate picture of what Jesus did? Gary Machuda, thank you for being here with us.
Hey, it's great to be back with you, Cy.
Yeah, congratulations on another book. Your library is getting to be the library of the books you've written. It's almost at Trent Horn dimensions now.
Oh, no, nothing like that. But at least it's like a kind of a intro shelf to the Trent Horn shelf.
Yeah, right. All right, a baby Trent Horn shelf.
That's right.
So what got you thinking about this? And by the way, if you want to ask about this, about why we would think anything that we know about Jesus is trustworthy, you're very welcome to call 888-318-7884. Anybody is welcome to call and ask those questions, 888-318-7884. So what brought you to write this book about, did you have questions yourself, or is this a question that you run into as an apologist?
A little bit of both. Yeah, it's first, I find it a really fascinating area of apologetics, you know, the question of could the Gospels have lied, the veracity of the Gospels, because It reminds me of like, you know, those old shows, the courtroom shows where you really do have to make a case for something and Weigh the evidence. And the other thing, too, is there's a lot of really great books on vindicating the Gospels, but they all, nearly all of them are written by evangelicals. Nearly all of them vindicate why our text today is identical to the original. And they also argue about how close the Gospels were written to that time. And they also look at extra biblical evidence and show how that squares with the Gospels, which is very good. But I always found it very thin, Cy, because it only gets you so far. And what I kept noticing with skeptics, atheists, is they would ask some really good questions that weren't answered by that kind of technique, like, how do you know it's just not all fabrication? You know, It could be a very early one, or they embellished or, just exaggerated certain things. How do we know that didn't happen? And the other thing, too, is even if you could establish that the text we have is the same and it was written close and all that, how do you know what the true meaning of it is? It's kind of meaningless because, yeah, we have a text, but everybody has their own guess on what the text means. You know, what's the point at the end of the day?
And that would be part of knowing what Christ really taught.
So I thought, you know what, as a Catholic, we can bring a lot to the table in this discussion. And that's basically what the book is, that and also a whole bunch of cool things I found in my research over the years.
The Gospel Truth, How We Can Know What Christ Taught. It's just out this spring from Gary Machuda. It's the latest book from Gary Machuda. Can I just start then with the most basic question? How do we know that the people who wrote the Gospels made an accurate recording of what Jesus said?
There's some things. You know, in my book, I follow your book, Cy, because the tactic you used was to kind of pique people's curiosity, right?
Yeah.
And your book with Jesus, which, by the way, is an awesome book. You should plug that as well.
Thank you. I will plug that. A Teacher of Strange Things, Who Jesus Was, What He Taught, and Why People Still Follow Him. Thank you, Gary. I love it when people invite me to plug my own book on my own show.
Yeah, there you go. And but I love your method, though, because it's like, yeah, what about that? So what I do is that what I show in the book is that Jesus, you know, it's almost as if he's divine, chooses Jewish culture to give his message in, which already had a mechanism for passing on large amounts of detailed information accurately from one generation to another. And so the first part of my book, I show how he taps into that mechanism. And so that lends, another grain of sand on one side of the scale. Okay, that lends towards it being authentic. Another thing, too, is that the New Testament Gospels show evidence of being formatted. Now, what I mean by that is that, you know, there's certain things that we know. We may have heard it once when we were kids, and, like, we can recite lyrics of songs or poems or rhymes, you know, 30, 40, 50 years later, word-for-word accuracy. And the reason is it's formatted. It has a certain rhyme, a certain rhythm.
Right.
You know, there's certain things about these things that kind of embed in our memory. And you see the same thing in the Gospels, that there are all these different layers of mnemonic formatting, you know, where if you weren't aware that they're doing this, you know, it just sounds like Bible-ese, like, oh, well, that's how people talked in the first century. But actually, a lot of it is this kind of formatting where things could be memorized and then recited with accuracy. And some of it's there, and you can see it in your English translation. Some of it you can only see in the Greek, which is the oldest manuscripts we have. And curiously enough, Cy, some of it is buried under the Greek, because there's areas where the Greek speaks as if it's a Hebrew or an Aramaic person speaking in the Greek language. And so, you know, I ask in my book, if you're going to fabricate something, first, why would you have all these mechanisms for memory embedded in it? I mean, a lot of them.
Right.
And the other one is, if you're going to do that, why would you hide it from your original readers, right? Because the original readers were Greeks, or at least they read Greek. And, you know, if you're going to try to pass it off as authentic, why would you hide the very thing that you're using to pass it off? So that's the first stage. It's like, you know, these Gospels are strange. They're definitely not legendary accounts. They're not fabrications. Or if they are fabrications, it's like the most overly engineered fabrication in human history, okay, when you look at all the different layers.
Right, so you can, when you look at the, say, the Gospel of Mark, the very first Gospel, I don't know, 20, 25, 30 years pass between the time of Christ's leaving this earth to the completion of that gospel. But you can see that parts of that gospel, which is in many ways, it's not like it doesn't read just like a single, it does read as a single story arc, but it also reads as almost like trailers, you know, like here's a clip, here's a clip, here's a clip. Yeah. And that you can see in these, in the individual clips, which we call the gospel reading at Sunday Mass very often, that they're structured so that somebody who spoke Aramaic, for example, would be able to remember that snippet.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yep. And even in Greek, too. The gospel, or, you know, Jesus, when he's giving these discourses, even, he does it in the form of Hebrew poetry. Again, you know, you have rhyme and rhythm. There are certain beat patterns. There are certain, you know, with Hebrew, the interesting thing, it isn't rhyming words, but it's rhyming meanings. So each line, for example, one line will state something and the other one might expand on it. That's one way. Or the second line may contrast it, you know. Many are called, but few are chosen, right? So one's positive, the other one's negative. And there's all these different variations of rhyme, you know, Hebrew poetry being evolved. And so even if you forget part of it, if you just know, just like when I say Mary had a little lamb, you could fill in the rest because you know the rest has a beat like da 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 da, right?
Right.
Mary had a little lamb, da 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 da. And you know that you could reconstruct the part you forget based on, you know, just a portion of what's being said.
That's so interesting what you said about the phrase, many are called but few are chosen, because it's almost an unforgettable phrase. Like once you've heard that little pattern, and Christ himself does this over and over again in the way that he speaks to people, that that's a kind of unforgettable way that he said that. Not unforgettable just because, oh, that's the greatest thing that was ever said, although much of it is, but because he speaks in patterns. He has patterns of speech that are easily remembered.
Yeah. You know, this is one of the coolest things that I ran across, but this idea of, you know, certain portions of the New Testament Gospels are, you know, have this Hebrew Aramaic thing. In the Benedictus, okay, in Gospel of Luke, there's a couple of lines that's really interesting. It says, to perform mercy promised to our fathers, to remember his holy covenant, the oath in which he swore to our father Abraham. Okay, so in English, okay, that's nice, but I don't see where there's any memory devices. Now, when you look at it with a view to a Hebrew original, okay, what you find is the word to show mercy is hanan in Hebrew, which is the same root as Yohanan, which is John, the name John. To remember is Zakar in Hebrew, which is the same root as Zachariah. And to swear an oath is Shaba in Hebrew, which is the root of Elishaba, you know, Elizabeth. So in those three lines of the Benedictus, you happen to have the roots of the three names of the main progenitors in the narrative.
Oh,
right?
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. But if you didn't know Hebrew, you know, it would just be the lines are just there. But if you're familiar with the Hebrew backing, you can remember those lines like that. You just remember John, Zechariah, Elizabeth.
888-318-7884 is the number. The book is called The Gospel Truth, How We Can Know What Christ Taught. So we start then, before I go to the first break, I just want to, you've already given us one of the ways we know what Christ taught is that we can see that these things, before they were ever written down, were given in a form that was meant to be memorized to a people who had a habit of memorizing things in just this very way. So yeah. That if you can identify that, you can say, well, this looks awfully reliable, because why would somebody who made it up and wrote it down 25 years later write it in a Greek way that pretends to use all these Aramaic mnemonic devices?
Yeah. That at least it lays the groundwork, right?
Yeah.
But you could still say, okay, well, maybe at the very beginning that was all fabricated. How do you know Jesus actually did miracles and the things that are claimed in the Gospels? And that's like the next step where, all right, you know, I have a section with Dare to Verify.
Well, let's get into a little bit of that when we come back. All right.
Okay. Sounds great.
The great Gary Machuda is our guest. He's got another book, and it's a beauty, The Gospel Truth, How We Can Know What Christ Taught. What an important, important question, and a strangely neglected one. We'll get into more of it with Gary right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
If you've never been to EWTN's free family celebration, this is your year. Your EWTN family is waiting for you where it all began in Birmingham, Alabama. Join us Saturday, August 26th as we celebrate Mother Angelica's love for the Eucharist and mark the centennial year of Mother's birth. For more information on this free event, visit EWTN.com/family celebration. We want to see you there.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Gary Machuda is our guest. The primary way you probably hear Gary Machuda's name here on this show is Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger. There's a new and improved edition of it a year or two or three ago. I'm not exactly sure. Since COVID, I don't know how time passes in weird ways for me now. But you probably hear us give that book away. But Gary's got lots of wonderful books, including Hostile Witnesses, about how the enemies, the early enemies of Christianity, actually proved Christianity. Revolt Against Reality, one that I just highly recommend if you want to understand the moment we are living in now. It's not just that people are losing their way. It's that there's a revolt against the real world going on. And Gary highlights how that's happening and how Christianity is a remedy for that. And now he's got this wonderful new book, The Gospel Truth, How We Can Know What Christ Taught. Because one of the things, Gary, that we get in the modern world is not that's not true. But like you make a statement and people don't say, well, that's not true. They go, well, how do you know that? And how do you know that for sure? There's this turn away from struggling over what's true and what's false to struggling over how can you even know any of it in the first place? And your claim here is that we can know what the man Jesus taught.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the book, I talk about the dare to verify, right? Let me give you an example. You go to the bank with a check for $5 or $10, you know, my usual pay for the month.
So your paycheck for the week. Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. they run it through. They give me the money. It's no problem, right? So, but yeah. if I went to the bank with a paycheck like yours, like hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, right?
Exactly. I got to get verified every time. We got to put a hold on this for a couple of weeks. Your salary is
so huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they got to check your ID. You got to go there. You're not going to get the money. The reason is because a check that amount is a risk for the bank. They could be out all that money if the check bounces. So they're going to do everything they can to minimize the risk and double check to verify that the funds are there. Well, you know what? If you think of that analogy and apply it to the Gospels, what you find is the claims about Jesus are like checks that are being written. And these are huge checks, right?
Right.
These are claims about Jesus raising people up from the dead, about Jesus being the one God of Israel, Jesus suffering, dying, and rising from the dead. These are, you know, millions of dollars in check, promissory notes, in
right.
a sense.
Yeah.
So that raises the point, well, can it be verified and did people verify it? So in the book, I go through and show that it would be very hard to perpetrate a hoax, given that Jesus did this in front of multiple audiences that were on stage. There were skeptics there. I set that table. But I think the coolest part is it really would have been incumbent upon the earliest people who became Christians to verify whether the stories in the Gospels are true. And one of the funnest parts of the book is I find things in the Gospels that kind of are dares to the audience to check out stuff, right? So let me give you one of my favorite examples.
Okay, yeah.
The Bread of Life discourse, John 6, right? Jesus says, you must eat my flesh and drink my blood. And he says it multiple times in John 6. And, you know, we're familiar with this as Catholic apologists, because it's very striking. This is the only discourse where Jesus actually loses disciples. Well, if you're reading the discourse, you find something that's really curious. And this always bugged me. Right after Jesus says this over and over again, it's almost like the narrator jumps in. And it's like those old broadcasts that they used to have. We interrupt this program to give a very
right.
important message, right?
Yes.
Then they tell their spiel, and then now back to your regularly scheduled program. Well, like right after Jesus says this, the narrator, John, jumps in, and he says something like, these things Jesus said while preaching in the synagogue of Capernaum. Now back to your regularly scheduled broadcast. It just goes on as if nothing happened, you know?
Okay, yeah.
And it's like, why did you have to jump in and give this little bit of information, you know? And scholars will say, well, maybe the discourse was two discourses and it was stitched together and stuff like that. But I think there's a much better and simpler explanation. And that is, right after Jesus says these words, the original readers of John would have said, did he really say that? you know, because think about it, his own disciples leave him.
Right, right.
So John has to jump into the text and say, he said it at this particular location with the people that go to that synagogue. And it's almost like, I double dog dare you to go to the synagogue.
Go ask him.
And check it.
Yeah, right.
So he gets the location, the people. And since, you know, becoming a Christian in the first century and even afterwards, regardless if you're Jewish or Gentile, it would have been a social death sentence. I mean, and maybe even a literal one. I mean, you could be beaten. You could be kicked out of your home. You have a lot to lose, right? So there's already this preemptive need to verify. But then you have these challenges, you know, in the Gospels that,
right, you know,
like John stepping in and saying, hey, he did that in this location right here. Well, check it out.
It's, I mean, outside the Gospels, Paul says 500 people saw it. That also seems like kind of a, you can go ask them. Like
you said some are still living.
Yeah. So, okay. So this also tends toward the veracity. Like if you're giving the means of verifying the sayings, mm-hmm. or at least trying to give the means that so someone could verify the sayings, this would suggest you're not just making things up, in other words.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, it would have been incumbent upon them to check it out, and they did. For example, at the beginning of Luke's gospel, that's why Luke wrote the gospel, was to essentially, he says, he verified everything. He checked everything new, and he puts in the orderly sequence for a guy named Theophilus who was being catechized. And so we know verification happened. For example, Luke verified. Yeah. You can also see that at the end of John as well, that, you know, there's a second ending to John in chapter 21. And it says, we know that his words are true. You know, you have to say, okay, how do you know his words are true? Well, either they were there or they verified it, right?
Yeah.
Because this mysterious we jumps in there and says, right, we know this is true.
Again, 888-318-7884. And I am going to go to callers. I just have to ask about one more thing before I do, because okay. I think this is going to stick in the mind of the person listening who might be skeptical. And when you talk about those big checks that need to be verified, the claim that Jesus did miracles, and really, I mean, in the Gospels, the claim is that he basically is going everywhere doing miracles. Like the Matthew says he healed all who came to him at one point, you know, like they're not saying, well, yeah, he one time in this area, you know, this way out of the way out in the country, you know, like UFO stories always are. They're saying right in front of everybody, he did miracles. This is a big fat check. And the miracles are not, they're not card tricks. They're guys who were blind from birth, or guys who sat at a pool and couldn't walk for 30 years, or children who were dead, you know, and got back up. So really, Gary, to the skeptic, is there a way to say, well, you can trust that Jesus did these things?
Yeah. That and, you know, a lot of it's just common sense, Si. It's, some of it's done in big cities. And, you know, in big cities, it's easy to be anonymous. And,
right,
you know, things could, even big things can happen and people don't notice it. A lot of them were done in smaller towns. And if you ever grew up in a small town, you know, since there's not a lot happening in those towns, whenever something even marginally interesting happens, it's remembered for generations, you know.
Right.
So
if Jairus's daughter was actually dead and got up, this is not something they're going to forget about. This is something that's part of that town's memory for a long, long, long time.
Yeah. In fact, there's an early church father called Quadratus. Okay. He's writing, I think, in the 120s. We have a fragment from him. And he makes a real important point. He says, you know, some of these people that Jesus raised from the dead or cured, it's not like they disappear. They continue to live. So, you know, so Jairus' daughter, for example, you know, it wasn't just that one-time moment. She's continuing to be around, you know.
Right.
And especially for miraculous healings where the condition is like the man born blind. people would know him because they've been around him all his life. They know his situation. They know the extent of whatever's afflicting him. And so, you know, there's this body of data that they could bring to so that when he's instantaneously healed, you know, they could verify that this is something dramatic has happened. You know,
which is maybe why you don't have a lot of early literature of people going, Jesus never did these miracles, because they really couldn't make that claim. There were people all over who had seen it and were even the beneficiaries of those miracles.
Yeah, right, like hostile witnesses.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. But we'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Gary Matuta on Catholic Answers Live. Want to get right to the core of Christ's saving message? Want a roadmap for living the life Christ calls you to? It's time to look again at the Beatitudes. In his new book, Heart of the Gospel, How the Beatitudes Show Us God's Plan for Happiness, Father Sebastian Walsh demonstrates compellingly how these eight declarations make up the foundation, the essence, and the final goal of Jesus' teaching. Heart of the Gospel illuminates the scriptural passages from which we get the Beatitudes, explains the significance of their wording, their order, and their timing in Jesus' ministry. And it draws out edifying parallels and connections with salvation history and the lives of the saints. Most importantly, Father Walsh offers wise counsel from his own work as a priest and teacher to help you live the Beatitudes in your own life. Order your copy of Heart of the Gospel today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I hate to take even a few seconds away from the great Gary Matuta. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. If you've ever had a how do you know Jesus said that? How do you know Jesus did that? How do you really know Jesus meant that? If you've got those kind of questions, this hour is for you, and I want to invite you to call 888-318-7884. But I also have to read this little sheet that Carrie gives me. This weekend, 25% off every purchase over $25 when you use the promo code USA25. That's right, USA25 at checkout. Whatever you get at Catholic Answers, if it sums up to more than $25 or more, you can use that promo code USA25 at shop.catholic.com and get 25% off your entire order. And that includes, you know, great books like Revolt Against Reality or Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger or any of the great books we have over there at shop.catholic.com. I didn't ask you the question about the meaning, but there is that question. I mean, one of the basic critiques of Christianity is, look, the same people read a Bible passage and 10 people read a Bible passage and come up with 10 different meanings for it. So that proves, that's kind of given to us as a proof against Christianity as a reasonable religion. So, I mean, I asked you about how we can know what Jesus said or have any confidence that these were actually the words of Jesus. How can we have any confidence that he actually did miracles? But how can we have any confidence that the church is right when it interprets the meaning of what he said?
Ah, yes. And this is fun. I was interviewed earlier this week by our good friend Pat Flynn. I believe you've had him on the show as well.
Love Pat Flynn, yeah.
Amazing guy.
Right.
Well, he brought up that his 9-year-old asked the question of, you know, how do we know that this stuff's true? It's not a lie. And so he asked me the question, how would you explain to a 9-year-old you know, how we can know it's true. And it was funny because it's like that fits perfectly with my book because it really does get very simple. For example, let's do a thought experiment. We go in our Wayback Machine.
Okay. All right, Mr. Peabody.
Yes. And you could be Mr. Peabody the Great and I'll be Sherman.
Okay, Sherman.
So we go to first century church. John the Apostle is the pastor.
Okay.
And during service, John is reading from his own gospel. He reads the Bread of Life discourse. He says that Jesus is talking about the Eucharist. Now, you know, me being Sherman, I say, gee, Mr. Peabody, how do we know that Jesus really was speaking about the Eucharist, not just symbolically or something, right?
Yeah.
So you being Mr. Peabody the Great says, why don't we talk to him? So we go up to him. We ask him, how do you know that's the meaning of the text? Well, he says, well, Jesus told us that this is the meaning. And that's, you know, I was inspired by the Holy Spirit to write my own gospel. And so that's the true meaning of the text. Now, that's one way you can verify, but there's actually others. For example, we could ask the people in the congregation who also may have heard of Jesus or the other apostles, say, hey, are you familiar with this? Did you ever hear that this is connected with the Eucharist? And they should give us an answer, right? Now, let's say we're really skeptical. Let's go to the churches of the other apostles and ask them, you know, John said this is about the Eucharist. Did Jesus really say this is Eucharistic? Now, if all these different places we check all have essentially the same answer, then multiple attestation, kind of coalescing into a single answer points to a single point of origin, right? So then we could say, yeah, okay, Jesus really did mean that when he said X, right?
Yeah.
Now, me being the skeptical Sherman says, Mr. Peabody, what about, you know, a generation later when the apostles are dead? So we go in our Wayback Machine. This time we go to, let's say, Ignatius of Antioch's church, okay? Ignatius was the bishop, two bishops after Peter, okay? So he's preaching on John's gospel. He says it's Eucharistic. We go to him. How do you know? He says, well, my predecessor and I, we were taught by the apostles. They said this is what it means, okay? Then we can go to the congregation, say, hey, you were here when the predecessor was here. Did he ever preach on this? Right. And then if we're really, really skeptical, we could go to other churches that were established by the apostles and ask them. And again, if you have multiple attestations coalescing in a single answer, that points towards authenticity. So you can take this just step by step, generation by generation, Cy. Say the Irenaeus of Lyon, who is a disciple of Polycarp, who was a disciple of John, do the same kind of thought experiment and actually our ability to verify actually grows, right? Because now you can talk to congregants, you can look at hymns, you could look at liturgies, you could talk to people who knew those people.
Right.
And so instead of verification becoming harder as the centuries go on, it actually becomes easier and easier to verify when an innovation occurs. Because if something's true, it should be traced as far back as you can go, so antiquity.
Yeah.
It should be found in all places, which is called ubiquity. And there should be a general consensus that all points to the same point. And antiquity, ubiquity, and consensus is the rule of St. Vincent of Lorraine, right? So so we can know the meaning through this kind of exercise. And you know what's cool, Cy, is in the early church, people did that. Like there's a father we don't know a lot about, but his name is Hegesippus, who actually did that. He went to different churches and started comparing different teachings. And, you know, Irenaeus of Lyon in book 3, chapter 3, at the beginning of that, he mentions that everywhere around the world, they believe the same thing. Well, how does he know that? Well, he lives in modern day France, was Gaul, but he came from probably the Smyrna, you know, where Polycarp was.
Turkey.
Yeah. So, you know, he traveled. You should know.
You know,
so you actually have that in the early church where people are actually verifying tradition, that is verifying the meaning of certain things and certain teachings.
This is I love that you just did that because one of the afflictions of the modern kind of ahistorical mind, that is we don't know our place in history. We don't know where we fit in history. We're kind of just almost creatures who are adrift from history. We're so disconnected from it that I think there are millions and millions of people who think that Jesus existed in such a dark and distant past that we don't have access to the apostles. Like, they would be amazed to know there are people who knew the Apostle John, who then wrote down what the Apostle John, so that there's not a discontinuity. There's a very clear continuity, and you can name the people. You just name them, Ignatius, and you could have named more. You could have named Clement, you know, who knew Peter, and wrote a very long letter. As a matter of fact, I think the longest letter in the ancient world Clement wrote, almost as long as the letters popes right now. So this sense that Jesus did not exist in a world that is completely opaque to us. We have the records of the people who lived at the very same time he lived, were his contemporaries, and then the people who followed them and went to school with them, you know, and tell us, I sat at the feet of John, you know, and that's how I know this. That's to me such striking evidence in favor of Jesus against this modern mistake that thinks that the ancient world and the world of Jesus is opaque and so far away that we can't know it. We really can't know it.
Yeah. And if somebody innovates, let's say Arius in Alexandria, then that thought originates at a distant pace time, like the fourth century. It starts in a particular location, namely Alexandria, and it will be a minority position, at least initially, right?
Yeah.
Because it actually expands quite rapidly. But, you know, so it's not only can we verify the truth of the meaning, but we can also identify innovations. And identifying innovation actually becomes easier and easier as you go through history.
Yeah. And being able to identify an innovation means that there is a constant teaching.
Yeah. Right.
That's exactly what verifies for us that there is a constant teaching, that you can look at what Arius taught and go, no, that's not consistent with what was taught from the time of the apostles.
Right. And that's why we name heresies after the heresy arc, right?
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like, that's the port of origin. Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes they were people that didn't mean to be heretic. Like Nestorius, I think, came back, didn't he? He repented of what's called Nestorianism.
Yeah.
Did he? I think he did.
Now you're putting me on the spot.
Might have the wrong guy. I do that sometimes, but so maybe Nestorius was the worst guy ever, and I'm sorry that I just tried to rehabilitate him. Bernadette in Nebraska, listening on EWTN.com. We're glad you're here, Bernadette. Go ahead with your question for Gary.
First of all, this is my first time calling in on Catholic Answers. And second of all, my first post was on Catholic Answers on Facebook. And I was a credo Catholic and, you know, did my idiocy for 15 years, and I'm back in the faith.
Praise God.
I'm learning so much. I'm learning so much from Catholic Answers on Facebook. So thank you very much. And
no,
thank you for this opportunity to speak. This is a perfect subject for me. Brant Petrie's, I forget the name of the book, but he talks about reading John 6 daily, which I do most days, and I keep my Bible open to those pages and to read about the miracles. But the question is, a priest, I heard it directly in a daily mass, you know, that the miracle was because everybody shared their food. And I'm just kind of trying to get better discernment on the motive, and maybe this isn't the right intention, but this is, he's a little bit of a controversial priest, and there's been other things going on. So I'm just trying to understand, why would a priest even say this? There's the conspiracy theory that, you know, that somebody said the Vatican is specifically implanted many priests to you know, produce false doctrine and teach people the wrong way. The fruits of this priest, you know, are exactly that. I'm not saying he is, but just to play the devil's advocate, why would somebody, you know, specifically negate the miracle of the 5,000 and say the miracle was that they shared, unless there was malevolent intent?
Yeah. Well, you know what? We can't judge people's hearts or motives. So Why they do it, who knows? Maybe it could be just a need to try to make the Gospels quote unquote relevant to the listeners. And since sharing would be relevant, you know, he says that's the miracle. The problem is, I think the biggest problem is the text itself, because it simply doesn't say that, right? This is clearly a miracle that occurs, and it's an astounding miracle that occurs. In fact, right after, this is something I found really interesting, and I think this is a good defeater to this person who said the miracle is sharing, okay? Jesus does a series of miracles right after it. If you look at the different Gospels, he does the multi-location of loaves, like Frank Sheet calls it. Then he walks on water. He calms the sea. The apostles' boat immediately arrives at shore. And what I love is, like, in Mark 6, it talks about what happens when they got to their destination, right? The apostles were really unsettled. So ask yourself the question, which one of those miracles really unsettled them? Was it the fact that their friend Jesus was walking on the water? Was it which, by the way, that's something only God does in the Old Testament. Or is it the fact that Jesus calms the sea and the weather obeys him? You know, that's another thing only God does. Or the time miracle, you know, where somehow the boat arrives at its destination, like, almost instantaneously. You know, which one of those were mind-blowing? Well, in Mark 6, verse 52, this is one of my favorite verses. It says that, I'll do it in 51. It says, he got into the boat with them, and the wind died down, and they were completely astonished, okay, or astounded. They did not understand the incident of the loaves. On the contrary, their hearts were hardened. So with all those incredible miracles that shows Christ's divinity that occurred, what was the one thing that blew the apostles' mind? It was the loaves, right? Now, if the miracle was these people shared with one another,
yeah,
I don't see how that could possibly square, right? That doesn't seem very mind-blowing to me. But what's really mind-blowing is, like, what Frank Sheet says in this miracle, is that the self-same loaves that Jesus blessed and distributed was present in the stomachs of the 5,000 and in the 12 wicker baskets. So Jesus doesn't make more loaves. It doesn't say that in the narrative. Rather, those self-same loaves are multi-located. And that's what blew the apostles' mind.
Bernadette?
That was excellent. I wrote down the Mark verse. I'll review that. Very quickly, the same person, priest, talks about that Adam and Eve and Noah are mythological, not historical. I know this isn't specifically about Jesus' words, but again, I'm just trying to better discern during homilies and just get better educated. Yeah. Like, what is going on here? And how can you possibly, this priest is unapproachable. I've tried to speak to him and I just get radio silence because I'm a woman. I'm just trying to better discern when things like this come up. I've pretty much learned to just disengage from it and just keep my head in the missile all the time through Mass, because there's been so many, you know.
Can I just make a guess, Bernadette? I just want to make a guess, and you tell me if I'm wrong. This is not a young priest.
I've been a priest for 37 years.
Yeah.
When I asked him about something.
Yeah.
And
all right. So you maybe are
10 feet behind his father. So women literally do not challenge him.
Yeah. I'm just saying, for 37 years, if he's been preaching this, he's not going to change it because you don't like it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to better understand, just as an idiot Catholic, trying to get back to my faith and get better educated, which I'm doing thanks to you guys, how to better understand, like, what is going on? And is this person just completely lost? So it's more just to educate myself, so I have better discernment any time when I talk to a priest or anybody spewing stuff that I know is not a fact, to give me better understanding of how to potentially engage or not engage, because it's deeply upsetting. I mean,
yeah.
I've heard things, you know, on a Sunday Mass in front of, you know, dozens of people. And I almost pulled a Joe Scheidler and stood up in the middle of Mass and just said something like, but I didn't.
Yep.
And so,
well,
like for someone to try to suppose that Adam and Eve and Noah are not historical and mythological, how could that be any sort of benevolent intent?
Yeah, it's probably confusion. The church has spoken on this, and actually Jimmy Akin would be much better given all the documents. But essentially what the church says is these are real events that occurred, but it's telling history in a way that like normal historiography, modern historiography would. And so it could use elements from myths in order to flush out some special meaning in that. But the core of what it's reporting happened, you know. And it could be that he just wasn't paying attention during that lesson. He heard the word.
Or maybe he was and
read.
He went to the seminary in 1970.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I'm trying to be careful. But yeah, that's another problem too.
Yeah.
But, you know, what you do for me, whenever I encounter this, is I offer it up for the conversion of the priest, you know, whatever suffering you endure going there, and just learn about what the church teaches. And if you can, maybe form a Bible study or a study group from, you know, people within your church,
right,
and you can help educate them.
I have to go to the break. It's a beautiful. Thank you for the good news that you have returned to the full practice of the faith. That's always good news for us, and I'm delighted to hear it. And the church continues to struggle in her encounter with modernity. It's been hundreds of years, and she's still trying to get her story straight in this struggle in modernity. And there's going to be some who prefer a modern explanation, even if it contradicts what the gospel is clearly trying to teach. And what can we do but have patience and leave it in the hands of the Lord and correct where a correction is appropriate? I do have to take a break. We'll be right back with more. Gary Machuda on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley of the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
The destination for great Catholic audio programming is EWTN Podcast Central, featuring the best of EWTN radio, as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates across the nation, all in one place, all free. If it's central to the faith, you can find it on EWTN Podcast Central. It's like podcast heaven. Visit EWTN.com/radio/podcasts today.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. It is one of the things. Well, Gary Machuda is our guest, and he's got a new book called "The Gospel Truth: How We Can Know What Christ Taught." And that word "know" is one that the modern world just hates. That word that you could know anything for certain, certainly moral things or religious things. No one's supposed to claim to know things. We're supposed to believe things, but not know them. But we do know a great deal about Christ. We know because the gospel writers were reliable people. They belonged to a community of good-hearted people who wanted to communicate the truth, did not want to distort it, and were meticulous about preserving it because they knew that God had come among them as a man. Gary Machuda, our guest, has done a fine job of illustrating why you can know what Christ taught. But Gary, you know, the apostles themselves must have heard people saying, "Well, this is myths that you're." I mean, this priest that we just heard about from Bernadette is not unique in the history of the church. I mean, it's unique how it has assumed a position of dominance in the church in some places, but in the modern era. But they actually were quite explicit about the fact of them being eyewitnesses and not sharing myths was an important detail that you should attend to.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite passages, except I can never remember if it's 1st or 2nd Peter.
I'm 71% sure it's 2nd Peter.
There you go. Thank you.
I'm going to go with
we'll go with that.
The cleverly devised myths.
Yeah, we didn't follow cleverly devised myths when we made known to you the power or the glory of Jesus. And it talks about the Mount of Transfiguration, which, by the way, there were only three there, right, outside of Jesus,
right.
Peter, James, and John. And so it's maybe somebody, people, they doubted. Maybe they read, and by the way, this is all the Gospels have the Transfiguration. At least I think the Synoptics ones do. And maybe there were some people saying, well, you know, this heavenly glory and Moses and Elijah stuff, maybe that's just myth, you know, exaggeration. It didn't actually happen. Well, Peter basically says, hey, we were there. We were eyewitnesses of that. We heard, you know, the voice. We saw, you know.
Yes.
And so that becomes the normative means to interpret the Transfiguration. No longer you can write it off as a myth, because the apostles who were there said, no, this is how it happened, right? And he says that you know, that they have you know, you do well to follow us like a lamp in a dark place. You know, it becomes normative for understanding Scripture.
I looked it up, first chapter of 2nd Peter.
Why you're the great side.
Well, you knew. You were onto it.
I got Peter. I just didn't know which one.
Yeah. So the skeptic is still listening. I was surprised that we didn't have more skeptics call, actually, but it is the Friday before the 4th of July, a long weekend. So I'm sure there's a lot of people who are just in the car. They just want to listen and enjoy. And you are a very enjoyable person to listen to. But this fundamental problem of, even if I think that the Gospels are early and they were written by people who knew Jesus, how can you really be sure that Jesus taught this? So the skeptic who's driving to the summer vacation spot right now and listening says, Gary, I'm still not convinced. You got to give me more. Why would I believe that Jesus wasn't just, you know, what, maybe the Bart Ehrman Jesus. He's just an itinerant preacher, maybe not even that well educated, and all this stuff just got imposed on him by people later.
Yeah. I'll give you a couple. One, I touch on this book, but I actually wrote a whole book called Hostile Witnesses.
Yeah.
Right. Throughout history, there were people who were skeptics, like maybe yourself or the interlocutor, who had it in their best interest to debunk this Jesus fellow and his followers, right, to see him fall. And they were there, and we have evidence of what they said. And like I point out in the book, and not just first century, but later, they don't discount the miracles. They don't say it's a fabrication. The best they can say is it's magic, or if they're Jewish, they would say that it's demonic or magic. Yeah. You know, it's kind of one of those two things.
But they don't say it didn't happen.
Right. They can't say it didn't happen. Why? Because, well, some of these people are still alive. You know, yeah. They can say, hey, look at me. This is what happened to me. And so you have the people with that in their mind. You know, the other thing, too, and this is kind of what the Revolt from Reality book is if you see, okay, maybe this Jesus didn't do what he said. Maybe he was just a marginal Jew, like Meyer says, right?
Right.
How do you explain how the gospel revolutionizes Western civilization? Like, if the cause has to be at least equal to, if not greater than, the effect, right? So,
and the effect is so overwhelming. The transformation of the world by this message, I'm sorry that the music's playing, Gary. I could talk to you all day. Thanks. I really appreciate that you came in and did this with us. I want to say the book title and tell people where they can get it. And we can get it anywhere that you get Catholic books. It's Gary Machuda's book, The Gospel Truth, How We Can Know What Christ Taught. Get it and have a deepened confidence in the words of the Savior. Gary, thank you very, very much.
Hey, it's been a blast, Si. Thanks.
Coming up, Jimmy Akin, Open Forum, Catholic Answers Live.